welcome to the Old Time Radio Hour. I'm your host, Justine Ward, and this week we present an informative look back at the history of the CBS radio network. Started in 1927 by Arthur Judson with the idea of bringing symphonic music to the public, it wasn't long before William S. Paley and his investors took over and began the media empire that is still prominent today. Last week, we presented part one of this three-part series. And this week, we bring you the second hour of the three-hour special that was narrated by Walter Cronkite. In this show, you will hear about how CBS developed the talented entertainers of radio's golden age. Stars like Jack Benny, Bob Hope, and Burns and Allen brought entertainment right into American homes, starting at the very beginning of the network. Also, in this segment, you will learn how sports broadcasting came of age and the sportscaster was created. Teams had their own announcer, and with radio, the public would listen to the reports of the game in real time. Enjoy CBS at 50, an autobiography in sound, narrated by Walter Cronkite, first broadcast September 18, 1977 on CBS.
CBS Radio at 50, an autobiography in sound, a three-hour CBS News special broadcast. Here is correspondent Walter Cronkite to continue our report.
We're one-third of the way along the way in our review of the many-sided history of CBS Radio. It all began just 50 years ago today, on September 18, 1927. We've already looked back on two major aspects of that history, the variety of music heard on the network over the years, and the first 25 years of CBS News up to the year 1952. Entertainment on old-time radio was made up of many different sounds. Kate Smith.
When the moon comes over the mountain.
The sound of children talking to Art Linkletter.
Where does a good fairy get money to put under the pillow?
From a TV show.
Hedda Hopper giving the news and gossip of Hollywood.
At the Stage Door Canteen last night, our own Hollywood star, Jimmy Cagney, was MC. Phil Baker was there with his accordion.
Steve Allen at the piano. One of the best sounds of all on old-time radio was the sound of an audience laughing, being entertained. Jack Benny once described radio as a less confining medium than television.
Instead of a big, ugly glass picture tube, you saw the performers in your own mind. You painted your own big-as-life version of each moment with that loving, creative brush we call imagination.
For those who remember old-time radio, and equally for those who don't, we're on an odyssey back to those days to listen again to some of the sounds on CBS radio over the last 50 years, sounds that entertained.
And now Bill Schellert for General Electric.
Mary had a little lamb. Its fleece was white as snow. And everywhere that Mary went, the lamb was sure to go. The words in that nursery rhyme I just read were the first spoken words ever to be recorded. A recording made by Thomas Edison, one of the founders of the General Electric Company. And with that recording, the phonograph was born in 1877 at Menlo Park, New Jersey. Edison had a staff working for him then, the Insomnia Squad, he called them. They would work around the clock, stopping just long enough to grab a bite to eat or take a short nap. One of the members of this squad was a brilliant craftsman named John Cruzy. Edison had given him a rough sketch. Edison asked Cruzy if he could build it. He said, "Sure, what is it?" "It's a phonograph," Edison said. "What's it supposed to do?" Edison said it would record the human voice and play it back. The response to that was laughter. But the laughter turned to amazement after Edison demonstrated his new invention by recording and playing back the little nursery rhyme. The start of the phonograph was the start of something unique, For the first time in history, the average person could be entertained by famous and talented artists right in his own home. During this time, GE was working on the development of a broader field of entertainment for the home, radio. Soon, America was listening to comedy, drama, and news, in addition to music. And in the early 20s, GE was working on the biggest breakthrough of all, television. In 1928, General Electric made the very first television broadcast. It's been a long road getting from Mary Had a Little Lamb to Mary Tyler Moore, but it's been one paved with hours of enjoyment and a lot of progress. Progress for people from General Electric.
Now CBS News correspondent Walter Cronkite continues his report on entertainment. One part of today's CBS News 3-hour special, CBS Radio at 50, an autobiography in sound.
Old-time radio had spontaneity because it was a live medium in the early days. All the laughter you heard was real, and so were the fluffs and flubs. It was all part of radio. Among the biggest radio headliners who could make listeners laugh loud and long were Amos and Andy and Burns and Allen. George Burns and Gracie Allen started on the Columbia Network in the early 1930s and spent almost 20 years on radio, most of it on CBS. They made the transition to television and are still seen in late-night reruns.
You look worried, Gracie. What's the trouble?
I think too much, George. I'm afraid my brain will wear out.
Really? What do you think about?
Everything. Oh, I'm way ahead of other people. Look at that girl who married Cary Grant. Everybody says, what a smart girl.
Well?
I thought of marrying Cary Grant years ago.
You're thinking every minute.
I come from a family of thinkers. Big thinkers.
The biggest, the biggest.
My brother Willie is famous for thinking on his feet.
He is, huh?
Sure. When anyone asks him how much 2 and 2 are, he takes off his shoes and thinks on his feet. Yeah.
Amos and Andy went back and forth between CBS and NBC during their radio careers and went on to television, but only briefly. In later years, they were considered controversial by some. But in their heyday, Amos and Andy were the all-in-the-family of their era. Here's a famous episode.
But now, don't get nervous, Andy. That's the main thing, you see.
Well, you'd get nervous, too, if you was in my place.
I know.
Oh, this is a big thing, Amos.
Yeah. I got the ring now, you know.
Yeah, don't lose that. Now, what has I got to do?
Well, you say I do twice. You say that twice.
Well, why has I got to say it twice?
Well, the preacher asks you two different questions, you see. Then you say I do once, then he asks you another question. Then you say I do again, you see.
Yeah. You're going to be standing there by me, ain't you?
Oh, yeah, I is your best man, son. Yeah, now, don't get nervous, Andy. I know just how you feel, but take it easy.
My legs been acting like they've been made out of rubber.
Wait a minute.
Everything going all right now, Andy. Don't worry about nothing. Remember, I'm looking out for your interest.
Well, listen, Kingfish, why don't the thing start?
Yeah, well, I just... You will now join hands. I, by virtue of authority vested in me by the state and this church, I now pronounce you...
Amos, I shot.
Andy, you hurt
me. Amos, my arm, my right arm. Somebody done shot me in the arm.
Get a hold of him. Oh, come on, we're going to take him out here. Awa! Awa!
Listeners argued for months. Did Andy really get married? Well, we're ahead of our story. The beginning of CBS radio did not include such superstars as Burns and Allen and Amos and Andy. That was to come later. It all began, in fact, on this date, September 18th, 1927. A fledgling network of 16 stations went on the air for the first time, with a total of 10 hours to be programmed each week, most of it music and entertainment. The next year, 1928, a young man named William S. Paley came to New York from Philadelphia to run the new company with two thoughts in mind: to provide the best entertainment, news, and sports money could buy, and to make Columbia the number one network in the country. In time, he achieved both aims. By 1935, 8 years after the network's debut, it had grown from 16 affiliates to 97. Its profits that year, after taxes, were almost $3 million. And CBS was beginning to catch up with its competition. One of the reasons was that Columbia was able now to attract some of the top talent, like Major Bowes and his amateur act.
All right. All right. Good evening, friends. We start the dizzy spin of the Wheel of Fortune. Around, around she goes, and where she stops, nobody knows. Now first, Fred Kandan, K-A-N-D-A-N, North Bergen, New Jersey, popular singer. Do you work?
No, not yet.
Right into microphone. Have you studied music?
No, I haven't studied
music. What would you like to sing?
I'd like to sing Twilight on a Trail.
All right, let's have it. Fred Kandan.
When it's twilight on the trail, and I jog along, the world is like a dream, and the ripple of the stream is my song.
Fred, I'm afraid you're not quite ready yet either. Pretty young, I just got here a little bit.
Major Bowes was a part of a variety of network programming that was impressive in these years. Besides music, drama, and the daytime serials, which we'll look at in other segments of this broadcast, its range was rich and varied. There were quiz shows like Phil Baker's Take It or Leave It, poetry readings with Tony Wands, comedians like Joe Wanna Buy a Duck Penner, Judy Canova, Joey Brown, Eddie Cantor, even Fred Allen before he went over to NBC. Dr. Alan Defoe, the man who delivered the Dion quintuplets, gave advice on child health in a CBS radio series. There was even a series on mouth care. All this besides programs on religion and travel. The Voice of Experience, a program of advice to the troubled, and the rules of etiquette from the doyenne of the social graces, Emily Post. The more serious side of life in the 1930s, in the depths of the Depression, was not forgotten. A controversial priest from Detroit named Father Coughlin preached at the CBS radio audience, and a homespun comedian named Will Rogers kidded it. Both were fond of poking holes in Roosevelt's New Deal policies.
Counting all the families of American citizens, there are together 25 million men, women, and children in this nation after 4 years of the New Deal who are forced to eat the black bread of relief. Relief? Relief that has failed to relieve. Although the federal government in these 4 years has spent $10 billion to correct unemployment, and although counties, states, towns, and hamlets has spent $3 billion on the same project to relieve a situation that grew out of the sins of modern capitalism. And as a result of it all, we have accumulated more upon relief. We have accumulated approximately $50 billion of debts, of money poured down the rat hole of civilization. And God knows if we will ever break that immorality down in the minds of those of us who have some sanity left.
The $5 million that they're starting in to spend, we all know that that's too much money. It's too much money to take out and throw away or give away or whatever to do with it. We know that. We all know that. But until we refuse to take some of it and it comes our way, we ain't got much right to holler. Where's the money coming from? We're spending it. Well, I don't know, but just offhand, I'd say it's coming from those that have got it. No matter what we pay, I don't care whether we pay high taxes, low taxes, medium taxes, or no tax, anything, the yell is always the same, 100%. You know what I mean? We just yell 100%. Of course, we know our government is costing us more than it's worth, but do you know of any other cheaper government that's running around now? I mean, do you? I mean, if you do, they'll sell you a ticket there anytime. Now you can try Russia. I was over there.
A large number of women's broadcasts filled the network's daytime hours. Two of them were news broadcasts, but with a twist. Kate Smith, an early superstar on the CBS network, and her longtime broadcast associate, Ted Collins, combined his news with her commentary.
It's high noon in New York and time for Kate Smith.
Hello, everybody. The people of the United States preferred to take D-Day seriously and prayerfully. There was no confetti, no wild demonstrations. Instead, thousands of Americans responded to the good news in a much finer and better way. Throughout the country, they trooped to blood donor stations and war bond booths. War bond sales increased. Payroll offices of factories were swamped with bond buyers. Some cities started their fifth war loan drive early and have already sold their quotas. Yes, Americans are rallying behind our gallant armies of liberation storming Fortress Europe. But don't forget for one moment that the war is far from won. So here on the home front this noon, let's renew our determination to do everything we can to speed the day of victory for our fighting men. And now, Ted, what's new?
The Allied Army of Liberation is...
The other newscast was equally unusual. Wendy Warren and the News combined news headlines with a soap opera, and it ran on the network for 11 years.
Hello, folks. This is Wendy Warren with news reports from the women's world. But first, here's Douglas Edwards with the latest headlines.
The China war is flaming again today.
Douglas Edwards would then report the news, and Wendy, played by actress Florence Freeman, would give several fashion tips and then make the transition into her complicated life story.
Off the air. No visitors, no phone calls. Well, I'm off to the office, Bill. See you tomorrow.
Bye, Wendy.
Wendy is worried. Her manner is abstracted, her eyes clouded and perplexed.
Still no word from Anton. I was so sure I'd...
Domestic comedy, the situation comedy or sitcom, developed early on the network. Easy Aces, later called Mr. Ace and Jane, was one of the successful early ones. Goodman Ace, one of the most talented and highest paid writers on radio, was master of the deadpan, subtle school of comedy writing. He wrote the broadcast, which starred himself and his wife Jane, who was famous for her malapropisms.
When Jane and I think of buying something expensive, we talk it over. For instance, when we thought of buying a used car, we found it wasn't what it was cracked up to be.
We thought of buying a used car, but it wasn't what it was jacked up to be.
Even when Jane goes to buy lingerie, I make various suggestions.
Even when I go to buy lingerie, he's very suggestive.
One of us never does anything without letting the other one know.
One of us never does anything without letting me know.
The other night, after a hard day at the advertising agency where I work, I was sitting around reading the paper, and Jane was going over her shopping list for the next day.
Now, let me see if I've got everything down that I want to buy tomorrow. Toothbrush, soap, cleansing cream, mink coat, and lipstick. Anything you need, dear?
I like listening to radio. I used to like to listen, and I think everybody liked to listen to radio because it gave them a chance to see it in their mind's eye. There's a one-inch screen up there that everybody saw Fibber McGee and Molly's closet empty out and heard it through the sound effects, you see. And I think, and for instance, in a radio show, a girl in a pair of jeans and a sweatshirt can say to a guy in a sweatshirt and a pair of jeans can be together, and they put a record on of soft music, and he can say to her, "You're the prettiest girl at this dance," and that only costs nothing. On television, I've been running the thousands of dollars, the Japanese lanterns you gotta hang and all that stuff, you know. They make a big production out of that.
After the war, CBS began producing its own situation comedies. Comedies such as
My Friend Irma,
starring Marie Wilson, and Our Miss Brooks with Eve Arden and Gail Gordon.
Jane, the telephone's ringing. Jane, the telephone's ringing. Aren't you going to answer it? I don't know if it's for me. Well, take a chance. Take a chance. It's not your nickel.
Hello? Hello? Yes, yeah, she's here. Jane, it's for me. Irma?
You know, if Marconi knew that you were going to use the telephone, he never would have invented it.
Oh, Jane, I'm surprised at you. Alexander Graham Bell invented the telephone, not Marconi.
You see, I'm beginning to think like you.
Everybody knows that Marconi invented spaghetti.
On this book, starring Eve Arden.
That last
page, Miss Brooks.
But, Mr. Conklin, I wouldn't suggest that...
To sum up, I would like to read what I have written in this last paragraph. To wit, having observed Mr. Stone's educational methods, I am convinced that his outstanding talent is his ability to eat bananas while hanging by his tail. Believe me, Mr. Stone, these sentiments are dictated by a sense. Eat bananas while hanging by his tail!
Man has obviously taken leave of his senses.
But, sir, if
you
let me...
And when they return, this matter will be thoroughly investigated. Good day, Miss Brooks.
Miss Brooks, this speech. This isn't the speech I wrote.
I know it now, Mr. Conklin, but I didn't.
I hold you responsible for this entire fiasco. And believe me, Miss Brooks, you have no idea how severe your punishment is going to be.
Oh, yes, I have, Mr. Conklin.
Miss Brooks, where are you going?
Out to get some bananas. There's nothing like hanging by your tail from a flagpole to whip up an appetite.
As the 1950s dawned, the Columbia Broadcasting System had become the number one radio network. And this was due mainly to its array of stars and other talent. William Paley had come back from the war and in the succeeding years signed some of the biggest stars in radio entertainment to CBS contracts. His aggressive pursuit of these entertainers was called by some Paley's talent raids. They resulted in a lineup of talent, some new, some long established, that was hard to beat. It included Bing Crosby, Jack Benny, Amos and Andy, Red Skelton, Edgar Bergen and Charlie McCarthy, Lum and Abner, Ozzie and Harriet, Lucille Ball, Gary Moore, Burns and Allen, Arthur Godfrey, and Art Linkletter. Linkletter reigned on daytime radio for 23 years. Listen now to some excerpts from those golden years. Imagine that it's a Sunday night then, after a good weekend. You're in your favorite easy chair. Your head is back, resting comfortably, and your eyes are closed, and you're listening.
Now, Clip, you better can sell me. I'll mow you down.
From Hollywood, it's the new Edgar Bergen Hour with Charlie McCarthy. It's Sunday night, and time again, transcribed for Edgar Bergen and Charlie McCarthy with Mortimer Sturge, Effie Clinker, Ray Noble, and yours truly, John Heaston. Ladies and gentlemen, judging by the volume of mail, this is the part of the show many of you have been waiting for. Our advice to the lovelorn department. And here tonight to help us is our own expert on romance. Here she is, the next to the last of the Red Hot Mamas, Miss Effie Clinker. All right, Miss Clinker, carry on.
I'd love to if you're game. Oh, that Heaston sends me. Of course, I don't have far to go. Yippee!
All right, yes, yes. Flirting with John Heaston, why? You don't even know him. Would you actually go out with a strange man?
Is there any other kind?
Well, I must say, you're quite a lover.
Oh, yes, I must say so.
Yeah. Do men run after your kisses?
They can barely crawl after they are.
You've never been married, though, have you?
No, I never have, no. I came awfully close to one fella, but I couldn't get along with his family.
Oh, I see. Then you almost married.
Yes.
But you couldn't get along with his family.
Well, that's what I said.
Yes, I know, I know.
Yes. What, are you an echo?
No. Well, it's rather sad.
Yes, it was.
When those things happen, it is sad.
Oh, it broke me up.
Yes. What was it, his father that objected?
No, not his father so much.
His mother?
No, I couldn't get along with her.
I see. Well, who was it?
It was his wife.
His wife, I see. In a little while, you will be married to Marilyn Monroe.
Yeah.
You know, Charlie, there comes a time in everyone's life when he must learn about certain things.
Yes. Well, what do you want to know, Bergen?
What I'm trying to tell you, Charlie, is that... What I'm trying to explain to you, I don't know what you're trying to...
Charlie!
Oh, Marilyn Monroe!
I'm here!
beautiful.
I'm wearing my wedding dress.
Yeah.
Something borrowed.
Yeah, you didn't borrow enough.
We'll be so happy. Mm. I can see it now.
Yeah.
You and I by the fireplace in a kettle whistling.
Oh, who can blame it?
Charlie.
Marilyn, my dear, we were made for each other.
Kiss me, Charlie. Just to make sure.
Yes, gladly, all right. Ah, they're still playing our song.
Hollywood, the Red Skelton Program. Hey, buddy.
Well, Willie Lump Lump.
Yeah?
Hey, Willie, what are you doing here?
Well, let's not get nosy, Bob.
Well, what are you doing in a doctor's office? Are you ill?
No, I come in here to wait for a bus. Really quick, I came in for a few shots. That's what I'm in for.
Well, what kind of shots?
Oh, I'm not choosy, you know. I even brought my shot glass with me.
Willie, why don't you go home and sleep it off?
What, and botch up a whole day's work? Look, I don't know why I even talk to you. Every time I see you, you get to look worse and worse. You just don't look right. I've had a lot of queer DTs in my day, but you just don't look right.
Welcome you
to the Bing Crosby Show. And now, ladies and gentlemen, Bing Crosby. Okay.
Now, Ken, if you'll excuse me for a moment, I'd like to present a very unusual and special guest. Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer, Bob Hope.
Before we go any further, pal, I want you to know that I waited at home all day yesterday for you to drop by with my Christmas presents. You're going to come up with something, aren't you?
I was about to ask you the same thing.
Now, what have you got for me, Scrooge?
Scrooge, that's a nice thing to say.
I want you to know I put a lot of thought into this gift, and I think it's something that you'll cherish forever.
Oh, wonderful. Let's see if I can guess what it is.
Well, it's round, and it has a stone right in the center of it. A ring. It's a peach.
Well, isn't that nice? I'm surprised you could spare the fuzz.
In case anyone cares, I'm Dorothy L'Amour. Do you characters mind if I squeeze in here?
Just move in. I'll do the squeezing.
Down, Balto, down. Johnny. Now, duck, ruddy face. The shrimp boats are coming.
Hey, I don't have to worry. They're looking for live bait.
If you two will stop squabbling, I'll give you your Christmas present.
Gee, what did you bring us?
I knitted sweaters for both of you. Here.
Where did you learn to knit? This is only one sweater with four sleeves.
Well, you're always together. Put it on and shut up.
I hope it has a V-neck. I'm in television.
This is really very thoughtful, very sweet of you, Dottie. And, Bob, I think the fact that Dottie has brought us a gift poses a little problem.
What problem?
Well, come on, give Dottie her gift.
Oh, yes, I thought you had Dottie's present,
no,
Bing.
No, you've got it.
I have? Now, where did I put that?
Oh, come on, quit stalling. You didn't get anything for me for Christmas, did
That's
you?
That's not true. Go on, Bob, there's only one thing to do.
Oh, all right, all right. Here, Dottie, Merry Christmas.
Oh, isn't that sweet? A peach with a bite out of it.
The CBS Radio Network presents Jack Benny.
Now, let's see.
Well,
boss, I've got all the luggage in the car.
Good, come on, let's go. Are you sure all the lights are off and the doors are locked, Rochester?
Yes, sir.
Good. Okay, start the car.
Okay.
Maybe we got a little water in the gasoline.
I'd settle if we had a little gasoline in the water.
Never mind. Try the motor again, will you?
Yes, sir.
Hey, the motor sounds as though it's going from bad to worse.
Sounds like it's going from here to eternity.
Rochester, don't be funny. Try it once more.
Okay.
The motor's not even catching. Maybe the battery's dead.
Can't be that, Mr. Benny. I put a new battery in yesterday.
A new battery? How much did it cost?
Nothing. I got it out of your flashlight.
I'll try it once more. There you are, Rochester. The motor's going. Back the car out of the garage.
Wait till that crowd gets out of the way.
All right, folks, break it up. Break it up. Beat it. Beat it. Why do they always gather when we try to start the car? You can go, Rochester. They've gone now. Rochester, there's Miss Livingston's house. Put on the brake. That's good, Rochester. You stopped right in front of the house.
Yeah, and only took us once around the block to do it.
That's a memory of long-gone Sundays those of us of the right age can summon up again. A rehearing of the days when CBS Radio's entertainment lineup dominated the network and the competition. We'll turn next to the story of another noted CBS radio entertainer.
And now Bill Schellert for General Electric.
If you'd like to take a short walk through an exciting piece of the past, a good place to do it is in Speedway, Indiana. Out by the racetrack, where they run the 500-mile race every Memorial Day, is the Indianapolis Motor Speedway Hall of Fame. It's not just a museum of old race cars. It's really a museum of advanced engineering. Because each year, the cars designed for the Indy race represent the absolute limits of engineering at that time. No money or brains or time are spared to put together what the builders hope will be that year's winning car. In 1925, the winning car was a Duesenberg. That car's in pieces now, waiting to be restored and put on display in the Indy Museum. And when it is, you'll be able to see the device that helped it win, a supercharger built by General Electric. Funny thing, that supercharger wasn't designed for a race car at all. It was designed a few years earlier to set another kind of record, an aviation altitude record. And it succeeded. Took a plane up to what was then the amazing height of 34,000 feet and made aviation history. Around the same time, GE came up with some other remarkable aircraft equipment, like a radio altimeter that used radio waves to tell pilots how high the plane was, and the electric compass, a device that could actually help fly the plane. Today, GE's contribution is even more spectacular. The mighty GE CF6 jet engine now powers airlines in some 29 nations and is setting records for economy and efficiency. It's odd that the supercharger, which once set records in the air, should come to rest in a museum dedicated to records on the ground. But good engineering is seldom limited to any one place or any one use. It's needed wherever people want to make progress. Progress for People from General Electric.
Now again, CBS News correspondent Walter Cronkite reporting on entertainment, our special anniversary broadcast, CBS Radio at 50, an autobiography in sound.
One of the biggest and most durable star entertainers of radio was Arthur Godfrey, who spent almost every day of 38 years on the air from the 1930s to the 1970s. CBS News producer Andy Rooney wrote for Godfrey and remembers those days.
Godfrey has talked more words to more people than any person who ever lived, because he was on for an hour and a half simulcast, a phrase we used to use, meaning both radio and television at the same time, for an hour and a half, 5 days a week. He was on an hour Wednesday night, Arthur Godfrey and His Friends, which was always one of the top-rated shows, either one, two, or three. And then Talent Scouts was often number one. That was half an hour Monday night. And then there was a Best of Arthur Godfrey, which was just a collection of stuff taken from edited out of the week on half an hour on Saturdays. And nobody could have done it who didn't take it as easily as he did.
Now, in order to understand this career, you have to realize that the last thing I ever had on my mind was stardom when I started out. It never occurred to me that I would be a star ever, any time. I just wanted to be the man who did the best job of doing whatever he was assigned to do. Whether it was describing a parade or a football game or announcing for a program or whatever it was in the beginning. And they gave me that early morning chore of playing the records and telling the time. And it was just that I tried to make it entertaining.
He invented a whole style of radio, and people don't realize how important he was. And some of the people who are still popular owe their style to Godfrey. He invented Jack Parr, who's gone. He invented probably Dave Garraway. He invented Johnny Carson, in a sense.
It occurred to me that the only way you could achieve any longevity in our business was to grow in stature, to grow in interest. And so I tried to learn many different things, and to learn all about a lot of different things, so that I could speak with some sort of authority about them, or at least some familiarity with them, and keep my interests going and growing. And therefore, perhaps I would intrigue some people to stay with me. Then, of course, the big thing that I depended upon always was integrity, because I was positive that the only way in the world a man could sell is to sell himself first. And so I decided that I could be your companion, your confidant, the man upon whom you could... In whom you could place some trust.
He also started this huge trend that no one ever considered possible before of being disrespectful of advertisers.
Says here, Arthur, please announce that there will be a midnight show tonight of the women. And how about the women treating the men to this show? He says, talking about style, wait till you see that gorgeous $250 nightgown that is part of the Technicolor fashion show in the new picture, The Women. Fancy that, paying $250 for a nightie.
Godfrey was a real guy. He was talking to people, not performing in front of them.
What made old-time radio unique by today's standards was that much of it was live entertainment. Generally, the only place today where radio is still live is in the news and information area. And we asked CBS News correspondents Douglas Edwards and Charles Osgood to reflect on the two modes, live and recorded.
Doug, I guess the news area in both radio and television today is one of the last bastions of liveness anyway, isn't it?
Exactly, it is, and it's so refreshing, really, to do most of a news broadcast entirely live. Of course, tape is a marvelous adjunct today. It's one of our tools, and it works beautifully. But it, as you know, Charlie, has not always been so. For instance, in my early days at CBS, 1942 forward, we had no recordings, no tape. Everything was live, switches to all kinds of places.
So when you called in a piece from London, London came up
live? London was there, and if London was not there, or if the signal in the pre-testing period was not up to standard, I would fill London's part in New York, or we'd switch somewhere else. We usually had, for overseas pickup news programs, alternate spots to go to. Quite often, we would go to a pickup scheduled from Moscow. Now, in the talk-up from the correspondent in Moscow, we would ascertain whether their clock was working the same way the old clock on the studio wall in New York was. Most times it was not. Moscow would be either 5 seconds, 6 seconds fast or slow, or 20 seconds off, which meant in order to switch to them, we had to calculate the error in their clock in order to switch into the correspondent over there for his report. And I must explain one other thing, that the correspondent in Moscow could not hear us from either direction. He went live on a time basis.
That sounds like a mistake waiting to happen. I don't know. I guess we've all made fluffs. And I personally, Doug, and I'm sure that over the years you must have made one or two.
Oh, heavens, yes. One memorable one for me was on VE night. Over in London, Ed Murrow and I were in the BBC studios, and he did his piece and then switched over. And Doug, what have you been doing today? And I said, been broadcasting, Ed. But then I began my piece by saying, yes, indeed, it is VE Day in London. And at which point, a great many people are going to find this a little hard to understand. Edward R. Murrow just dissolved in laughter and disappeared under the table for a moment or two. And I had to finish the broadcast.
Yeah. Doug, that must have been a shade disconcerting. But you must be one of the few people in the whole world who can say that he caused the great Edward R. Murrow to drop under the table.
Entertainment, one of the great contributors to the building of CBS Radio. And in many ways, a broad base for the outpouring of entertainment to come later on television. Next, we'll look at sports on CBS Radio.
You are listening to CBS Radio at 50, an autobiography in sound. And now, Bill Schallert for General Electric.
One of the things that makes a great city great is its heritage, its people, places, and events. And Chicago, with its colorful 140-year history, certainly qualifies as a great city. It was Chicago that hosted one of the most famous sporting events in history, an event that General Electric had a hand in. The place was Soldiers Field Stadium, September 22, 1927. This was the night of the Dempsey-Tunney fight and the disputed long count. 150,000 people, then the largest sports crowd ever, turned out to see Gene Tunney defeat Jack Dempsey for the heavyweight championship of the world. Because the fight was at night, more people who worked during the day could attend. So Soldiers Field had to expand to accommodate almost twice its normal capacity. People were either climbing fences or perched on them to see the fight. And it would have been difficult not to see it, because GE had filled the entire stadium with light. Enough light to equal 300 full moons, all of it specially rigged and installed for the historic bout. That was quite an achievement in its time. The newspapers called it a gigantic spectacle. Others talked of the complete chaos in the stands that could have occurred if it hadn't been for the lights. People who saw the fight described it as having the clarity of day. We've come a long way from what was once thought unusual. Today, there's hardly a place you can go without finding some sort of baseball, football, or basketball game being played under GE lights. And there's ice skating, bowling, rodeos, track meets, sporting events of all kinds. GE has made a lot of progress adding to the hours of enjoyment in a day by adding hours of enjoyment to the night. Progress for people from General Electric.
CBS Radio at 50, an autobiography in sound. Here again is correspondent Walter Cronkite with our CBS News special broadcast marking the 50th anniversary of CBS Radio.
We have so far reported on aspects of news, entertainment, and music in the history of CBS Radio. Now we turn to another memorable area, sports. Sports has become a major force in American life, says James A. Michener in his book, Sports in America. We devote more money and time to sports than most of us realize, and sports consumes much of our listening, viewing, and reading time. Sports coverage on radio is only as good as the people who report it. When the Columbia Phonograph Broadcasting System, as it was then called, first took to the air on a muggy September afternoon in 1927, the 16-station network did not carry a single sports broadcast. But Columbia soon realized how important sports reporting was to attracting audiences and began an all-out effort to cover the regattas, races, games, and other events of interest to its listeners. Early coverage sometimes demanded extraordinary ingenuity, even daring on the part of the reporter, requiring him to cover the event from an airplane or atop a telephone pole to get the story and beat the competition. The same year the Columbia Network began broadcasting, 1927, a young New Yorker with 3 years of broadcasting experience was hired at CBS. He began as an announcer, but soon specialized in sports. And for the next quarter century, he was at the top of his profession and developed a style of sports reporting that set the mold for many who followed. Ted Husing.
Ladies and gentlemen, from the inside to the outside, Jesse Owens on the pole. Lennart Sandberg of Sweden next to him in second lane. Eric Borschmeyer, the German, Borschmeyer. Jesse Owens is running in white shoes today. Ralph is running in black shoes. And here they go, down on the mark. They're set. The gun sounds and they're away. And Jesse Owens comes down there with Ralph Metcalf. Jesse Owens starts moving. He's a yard or two out in front. Metcalf is coming second up on him. It's Owens, Metcalf, and Ozendorf.
The Ted Husing style was noted for its control and accuracy. Described as being able to bring you to the edge of your chair without screaming, his flow of language was such that Husing rarely needed to use the same descriptive adjective twice. Kentucky Derby of 1939 is an example.
This is Ted Husing speaking from Churchill Downs, the scene of the truest test in America for thoroughbred racehorses. A glamorous, colorful mile-and-a-quarter racing trial for three-year-olds. No sporting event in this country has more appeal than this annual race, which will shortly be contested for the 65th time. And thus it commands a tremendous amount of interest throughout the nation and annually brings a jammed-in crowd of sports followers to the track. Today is no exception, attracted by the hope of a truly run race by the field of 8 3-year-old thoroughbreds, the best available in the list of 115 nominations, the American race goer has come to Louisville to see the great Bluegrass Classic. Since early in the dawning when the first peep of light descended upon the town, until even now the fans have flocked to the racetrack. It is a scene of riotous color, a park in which thousands beyond count have taken over every available spot from rafter to fence to see the 8 racing machines do their stuff over the tortuous route of the race. Each horse will carry 126 pounds, and that is an impost that will decide a truly good horse when at last his nose flashes under the wire tautly stretched across the track. All the trainers vouch that their charges are in good condition, and when the ablest of the horses reaches the finish, the myriad fans assembled at Matt Wynn's track will roar a lusty huzzah to the winner. Since the time schedule...
Over the next decade, sports reporting became more sophisticated, and gradually the sportscaster was invented. No longer were random announcers assigned to cover sports events. Coverage was given to Husing and others who were beginning to specialize in sports reporting. Mel Allen was one of this new breed.
They assigned me as understudy to both Ted Husing and then Bob Trout, so that I was doing special events and sports, as well as station breaks and anything else that staff announcers were supposed to do.
Allen arrived at CBS in 1937, fresh from the University of Alabama Law School, and got a job on Columbia's announcing staff. He had no intention of staying at CBS, or in New York City for that matter, but after a few months realized he liked what he was doing, was making good money doing it, $100 a week, and sensed that radio and sports had a future together. Alan's ability to talk extemporaneously for long periods of time made him a natural for sports broadcasting, and in 1939 he became the voice of the Yankees on CBS radio.
Being with the Yankees was really a highlight because it was part of their great dynasty. DiMaggio was the greatest total ball player that I ever had the opportunity to see. There were many great ones like Willie Mays and Mickey Mantle and Hank Aaron and Roberto Clemente and so on. But as a total ball player, as a great leader, DiMaggio ranks number one. I remember one time when we were on a train traveling from one town to another, Joe had been in a slump, and I went by his bedroom on the train, and he was reading a book. I said, "Joe, may I drop in for a moment?" He said, "Yes." "Sit down." We got to chatting, and I said, "Joe, have you deliberately changed your batting stance?" And suddenly he looked at me. He said, "What do you mean?" I said, "Well, normally your batting stance is one that has your 2 feet touching the inside corner of the batter's box. Lately, your right foot has been pulled back further." He knit his brows for a moment and looked at me, and he says, "Are you sure of that?" I said, "Yes." In any case, the next day we were in Cleveland, and he had resumed his normal batting stance, and he hit 3 home runs that day. How about that?
Joe DiMaggio, the Yankee Clipper, the total player, also knew when to retire, and in 1951 held a press conference to announce he was bowing out of baseball. CBS radio listeners heard it.
"I feel that I have reached the stage where I can no longer produce for my ball club, my manager, my teammates, and my fans the sort of baseball their loyalty to me deserves. In closing, I would like to say that I feel I have been unusually privileged to play all my Major League Baseball for the New York Yankees. But it has been an even greater privilege to be able to play baseball at all. It has added much to my life. What I will remember most in days to come will be the great loyalty of the fans. They have been very good to me."
In the decade of the 1950s, sports was becoming big. Big as a spectacle, big as a business. Walter Lanier Barber, the old redhead, with his easy southern drawl, was one of the leading sports broadcasters, known for telling it like it was. In an interview with CBS News several years ago, Barber talked about his early days in radio.
"When you were the broadcaster at a microphone, you were the entire show. And you just tried to talk about what you saw. And one of the exciting things in the early days was the contest that never seemed to end between Graham McNamee and Ted Husing. They were always competing with each other. And one was going to outdo the other. I know that Husing was the first great technician as a sports broadcaster, and he was the soul of pinpoint honesty. I do the work that's given to me to do it as truthfully as I can do it, and if people like it, fine, and sometimes they haven't liked it."
The Columbia Network did like Red Barber's work, and in 1946 made him director of sports for the network. His main concern that year was the coverage of major college football games. That dilemma of trying to report the progress of more than one game led to an innovation in the broadcasting of sports that is now standard practice, and that is covering more than one event at a time. This enabled Barber to report on several important games the same day by linking the different remote locations to New York with open telephone lines. In a matter of minutes, CBS radio could air on-the-spot reports from different locations around the country. This was a revolutionary concept. Until that time, the unwritten rule had been never leave a game in progress. Also under Red Barber, sports documentaries began to be produced.
The CBS Documentary Unit invites you to play ball, to join a fast-moving tour of that wonderland of heroes, hullabaloo, and high finance known as baseball. But now, here is your guide, Columbia's Director of Sports, Red Barber.
Hello, everybody. This is the old redhead. We're taking the great dream of every American youngster, the dream of playing ball in the big leagues. And we're going to watch, step by step, as that dream comes true for at least one of them. One typical American kid. Finding him wasn't easy. We sifted through the roster of every big league club, ran through hundreds of names and mountains of statistics, until one day we turned the page, and there he was.
Crease, Harold H. Shortstop, Brooklyn Club. Bats right, throws right. Height 5'10", weight 170. Born July 23rd, 1919. Residence, Louisville, Kentucky.
Behind those cold statistics, we found a warm human story. We found Pee Wee Reese, a star and a symbol. His story might well have been yours. It still may be your kid's. It's the way one American boy worked to make his great dream come true. Well, Pee Wee, where would you say ball players come from?
Oh, no special place, Red. Anywhere.
You mean they even born like anybody else? And not just hatched out on a farm?
That's right, Red.
Well, where were you born, Pee Wee?
In Kentucky. Akron, Kentucky. That's near Louisville, Red.
And I don't suppose, young man, that you remember the circumstances.
No, sir, I don't.
I suppose I'm the only one who does. I'm Pee Wee's mother. But down here in Louisville, I had Pee Wee in our home in Akron. When they first showed him to me, he was just like any other baby. He was soft, red, and he squalled like all the rest of them. You couldn't tell if he was going to turn out to be a butcher or a ball player.
As the 1960s dawned, sportscasters began moving away from working exclusively for networks. They often were under contract to a team as well. This was the practice with many baseball clubs. For example, Phil Rizzuto, the New York Yankee shortstop, retired from active play in 1956 and was hired by the Yankees to broadcast their games on both radio and television. The next year, CBS hired him to do a network broadcast called It's Sports Time, which was heard on CBS radio for the next 19 years.
When I got the job, what I liked about it, I never liked to do anything on tape. And in those days, we did everything live. And I'd say, the first 12 years, every show was live. And I loved that because I like challenges. And you had to be right on time, and all the cues had to be right. And, you know, if you fluffed, you had to just keep right on going. I got a big break in two ways with Lowell Thomas. Lowell Thomas kind of liked me and was like a father to me and taught me so much about broadcasting. He got me to enunciate a little more clearly. Being from Brooklyn, a lot of people didn't quite understand what I was saying. And he did it in such a way that it didn't upset me or anything bother me. It was constructive criticism. Plus the fact that I followed Lowell Thomas in about the first 10 years, and a lot of people just wouldn't turn. You know how people are. They got the dial on that one station they want. And so I would get the overflow from Lowell's broadcasts, and it helped me tremendously, and he helped me tremendously in my career.
It's Sports Time with Phil Rizzuto.
Hi, everybody. Over the years, at least during my time, any list of the most respected college football coaches would include Frank Leahy, Red Blake, and Bud Wilkinson. In the professional ranks, there are two who come to mind. George Halas of the Chicago Bears and Paul Brown of Cleveland. The fact that Brown has been dropped as head coach of the organization he hatched from a chick into a full-blown eagle in a very short time following the war and kept it at peak efficiency for so long has nothing to do with the current case.
In the 1970s, the treatment of sports on the network continued to evolve. Now broadcasts had to be short and to cover as much ground as possible. CBS sportscaster Win Elliott developed a style that made the most of the airtime, and for the last decade of CBS Radio's first 50 years, the Elliott sound has been a feature on the network.
In this past decade or so, CBS has been part of an exciting, confusing, and nearly always spectacular world of sports. In baseball, Hank Aaron's record-breaking home run, or Lou Brock's record-breaking 105th steal.
Brock takes the lead. Ruffin checks him. He is going. The pitch is a strike. The throw. He is there. He did it. 105 for Lou Brock.
And the brilliance of the Yankee, Pennant, and World Series teams. In pro football, the Green Bay Packers, Miami Dolphins. And you remember the day O.J. Simpson ran 250 yards and broke Jimmy Brown's single-game record? Some of us thought that record would stick around for a while.
I don't think it's going to last all that long. 250 yards is a big day, but I think somebody's going to come up and get 300 yards one day, and I'd like to be the first guy to get 300 yards.
Gale Sayers, Johnny Unitas, Fran Tarkington. And as Don Klein saw it happen
on October 31st, 1972.
And now George Blando ready. At the threshold of another great milestone in this fabulous career of Blando's. Now playing in his 340th NFL game. The ball placed down by Stabler. Kick. Blando has the point. He has scored 2,000 points in his career.
Eventually, 2002. And you remember the American Football League and the New York Jets and the guy who made both of them happen.
New York's the city, man. This is the place.
Broadway Joe. They called Joe Namath.
It's fun, man. You go in Manhattan, people know you, and it's a great city. I wouldn't want to go nowhere else.
But time marched on, and for Joe Namath, it's now Hollywood and Vine. UCLA basketball under John Wooden. Unbelievable 10 NCAA championships in 12 years. And the players, Al Cinder, Goodrich, Wicks, Rowe, and lastly, if not first, a giant redhead who seemed born to play basketball.
I've been playing since fourth grade, and I've just always been able to play basketball.
Bill Walton further proved that by leading the Portland Blazers to an upset NBA championship over the Philadelphia 76ers just this year. Wilt the Stilt, Jerry West, Cousy, Havlicek, and the incomparable Boston Celtics. In tennis, Rod Laver, John Newcomb, Ilya, Jimmy Connors, Billie Jean, 19 Wimbledon crowns for Billy, Chris Everett. And after waiting 25 years for a horse like Secretary to win the Triple Crown, it happens again this year.
Seattle Slough is under a hand right, and he's going to take it all. We're coming to the line. It's Seattle Slough that wins it by two lengths.
And the Preakness.
We're coming to the line, and it's Seattle Slough that wins it by a length and a half.
The Belmont.
There's that finish. Seattle Slough wins by four with Dean Crugier waving his whip as he crosses under the wire.
Undefeated. Unparalleled is the word for hockey's Gordie Howe. At 49, he'd played with his two sons on the same team. Pele arrived, and seemingly so has soccer. And we lost some people in sports, too. Vince Lombardi, and...
I'm the only one left now that was with the Dodgers alive. I'm for the knuckleball pitcher all my life, even if I can't see now. Goodbye.
Casey Stengel's last appearance in public. In golf, there was Jack Nicklaus, Arnie, Gary Player, Miller, Tom Watson now, and thank the Lord there's still Sammy Snead.
I still enjoy playing. When I lose that, why, then I'll hang the shingle out. I've gone hunting or fishing.
Son of a gun, Sammy is now 65. A.J. Foyt's four indies, and of course the new era in sports, exposure, expansion, the new leagues, WHA, ABA, WFL, and that announcement out of Toronto in 1974.
The three of the greatest football players in the world, Larry Zonka, Jim Kick, and Paul Warfield.
And the very next year, the NFL strike. The New England Patriots refusing to play an exhibition game with the Jets.
The team met, and at 3 o'clock they decided to go on strike, and at 3:15 they left Schaefer Stadium, refusing to play tomorrow's game. And the strike thus means that they will refuse to practice.
There was a strike in baseball. Umpires struck. Basketball referees struck. And then the instant millionaires, the free agents, Julius Erving, Andy Messersmith, Reggie Jackson. Nobody knows where it'll end. Like the greatest golf shot in all history. Do you remember Al Shepard's shot on the moon?
Oh, here we go again. There we go. Ready to die. One more.
Miles and miles and miles and years and years and years. And like I said, Walter, CBS has been a part of an exciting decade in sports. And as we go into the 80s, as far as I'm concerned, it's only the beginning.
To sum up the lot, the life, and the loquaciousness of the sportscaster in covering 50 years of CBS sports, CBS News correspondent Charles Osgood puts it this way.
For many fans, and I am one, sports will never be such fun as once they were when distant cheers fell upon our youthful ears. Those games were of a special kind. The field was laid out in our mind. The cracking of the ball and bat as by our radios we sat. The pop into a glove or mitt, that thrill of some important hit. At games they carried on the air, the voices made us feel right there. The winning, and sometimes the losing, spelled out by Barber, Allen, Husing. No Summerall and no Jim Kelly yet, but Phil Rizzuto and Win Elliott would give their colorful reports on all the major news in sports. Think back, and you can hear them now. Someone saying, "Holy cow!" And someone else with Dixie Cool saying, "Well, I'll be a suck-egg mule." In victory or in defeat, it was we who sat in the catbird seat. I miss those days, and can you doubt that? You do too? Well, how about that?
We'll continue CBS Radio at 50, an autobiography in sound, with a look at half a century of radio drama. I'm Walter Cronkite, CBS News.
Thank you so much for listening to part two of CBS at 50, an autobiography in sound, narrated by Walter Cronkite. This is the Old Time Radio Hour, and we broadcast the show each week over the World Wide Web with subscriptions available through Podbean or iTunes. Next week, we will conclude the three-part history of CBS Radio with more about CBS during the golden age of radio, with children's programming, detective and mystery shows, as well as soap operas and dramas. They also describe what radio has become since the golden age, a place for news and information. I hope you can join us again for that informative and interesting program. Until then, this is your host, Justine Ward, saying so long for a while.